Without further delay, I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Chaya. Chaya is the founder and director of Pediatric Occupational Therapy Services in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is actually my neighborhood, and I can say she's extremely well-respected. She is certified in the Sensory Integration and Praxis Test, Interactive Metronome, Therapeutic Listening, the Listening Program, and MEDEC, and is trained in floor time. She lectures extensively to parents, teachers, and therapists, and teaches a pediatric occupational therapy lab at NYU. She believes in a two-pronged approach to treating children with sensory processing dysfunction, both providing strategies to help the child, you know, for the parent and the teacher, to survive the day-to-day, coupled with intense clinically-based therapy to eliminate or minimize the underlying problems. So I'm thrilled to pass the control over to Chaya, and Eitan, if you could do that, and we can get going. All right, Chaya, you got it.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep, beautiful.
Okay, thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and I'm going to dive right in because I have lots of information, and just to give you a warning, I put lots of slides in here, and if I don't get through all of them, the slides that I will skip have all of the information in the PowerPoint, so don't panic about that. So, sensory is a ubiquitous word these days, but what specifically does sensory mean? During this webinar, learn about the seven senses, how to identify students whose behavior is sensory-driven, and develop a toolbox of strategies to utilize in the classroom during the most challenging times of the day to help students in preschool and in the early grades survive and thrive. Click on the hand clap icon if you have experience or suspect you have experience with children with sensory processing challenges, either as a parent or as a child. Is a parent or a teacher. Click on, great. Click on the check mark if you've click on the check mark if you've partnered with an occupational therapist to address sensory issues. So I see that lots of you have experience or think you have experience with kids with sensory processing disorder. Not surprising. Lucy Jane Miller, one of the foremost researchers in sensory processing, estimates that approximately 16% of young children have symptoms of sensory processing disorder. So chances are that one or two children in your class do too. So let me introduce you to three students who might resemble somebody in your class. Khani is a bright little girl who is easily overwhelmed during circle time and covers her ears during davening. She always seems to be in fight or flight mode with hair trigger reactions to the slightest provocation. When her friends sing loudly, tap on her shoulder, get rambunctious at the dress-up corner where she smells tuna fish, she darts under the table, hides in a cubby, or lashes out. At circle time, she either sits too close to or on the child next to her or scooches to the middle of the circle, never quite finding her spot. Although she has lots of play dates at home, during center time, even when she's having fun, she walks away when other children come near. She never ventures near the Play-Doh table and rejects glue, paint, and anything sticky. Whenever it is time to transition to a new activity, even when she likes, she becomes stubborn and defiant. In contrast, here we have Noam. He doesn't seem to react to anything in a rush, including the teacher's voice. He's lethargic, slow-moving, and often seems to have his head in the clouds. Whenever he's called on, he seems startled, but surprisingly, he often knows the answer. Noam slouches during circle time, often leaning onto the student next to him and rests his torso on the table. He has difficulty learning hand games, dance steps, and sports, and always seems 3 steps behind. He is clumsy and rough with other kids, but without an ounce of aggression. His constant humming annoys the teacher. Leora is completely different. She's in constant motion, changing positions, shaking her legs, and touching everything around her. When the class lines up, she gets too close to the child in front of her and tries to play with her hair. She often trips, falls, and crashes into her classmates, but she's a daredevil on the playground, spending as much time as she can hanging upside down at the top of the climbing dome. She is disorganized, her backpack and papers are a mess, and her handwriting is absolutely illegible. These three students have several things in common. They are sweet, bright children with unlimited academic potential, but they do not feel comfortable in their own skin, and they spend so much energy attempting to make themselves feel better that they seem to lack a social and cognitive awareness appropriate to their age. Adding to the confusion, their behaviors are inconsistent from day to day and from one environment to another. So a particular child might look perfect in a small group at the table, but act out during circle time and cleanup. Sensory integration, or sensory processing, we're going to use those interchangeably now, is the process by which the brain takes in and makes sense of the information that we get from our senses. So you're all familiar with the five senses: taste, smell, touch, hearing, and vision. All of us, children and adults alike, are sensory processing machines. As teachers in the classroom, you feel free to satisfy your sensory needs all day long with impunity, and no one can stop you. If you feel it's too noisy, you close the door or tell Sarah to stop humming. If you feel the need to move, you can pace, but you tell Johnny to please stop jumping up from his chair because it makes you seasick. If you want to avoid the proximity of 20 children, you can sit in a chair at circle time and avoid the crowd. Children have sensory needs too, but we do not typically give them the latitude to satisfy them, though the immediacy of their needs may far exceed ours. Let's see what happens when some of these five senses are derailed. That is, we feel too much, too little, or we misinterpret what we feel. Let's start with sound. Noam can't tune into sound. In other words, he is hypo or under-responsive to sound, and he either doesn't register the teacher's voice or all of the sounds in the room are equally compelling to him. Therefore, he most likely won't answer when you call his name the first time. To compensate, he might hum or sing to himself to generate his own sound. In contrast, because Chani hears too much sound, in other words, she is hypersensitive and over-responsive to sound, she might perceive the toilet flushing upstairs, airplanes flying overhead, student-teacher conferences at the teacher's desk as painful and distracting. She might refuse to get on a noisy school bus, enter the lunchroom, go to assemblies, and be anxious every day because there might be a fire drill, but she never knows when. Let's try that with touch. Because Leora is hyposensitive to touch, she doesn't feel enough. To compensate, she seeks it out to excess, hugging, bumping, and crashing into other children, and is surprised when they bark at her because she doesn't experience touch the way they do. In contrast, Chani is hypersensitive to touch. She feels it too much and perceives the slightest bit as painful. So when she gets a teeny-weeny paper cut, she wails inconsolably. When her friends get too close, she backs away from them because they might rub against her. And that inadvertent touch will feel like an assault. But there were two senses you did not learn about in kindergarten. They are proprioception and the vestibular sense. Proprioception is the joint sense. The receptors in the muscles and joints tell you precisely where all your body parts are at all times and how they relate to each other. In order to illustrate this concept, let's do an experiment, and I want you all to participate. So put your pens down, put your left hand in the air like the woman on your screen, and leave it there. Now, everybody ready? Touch your right index finger to your left index finger, now to your nose. Back to your index finger and back to your nose. Keep on going. Stop. By clicking on the hand icon, raise your hand if you were able to do that smoothly and efficiently rather than like a klutz. Excellent. Great. That was mostly a yes. Now, what sensation do you think enabled you to move your finger to the right place smoothly? Put your hands down and type it in the chat box if you think you know. Not vision. That just tells you that you know that the woman on the screen got it right. Touch lets you know that your finger got to the end point or missed, but not how it got there. It is proprioception, having a sense of your body parts in relationship to each other, that enabled you to move your right hand accurately using the most efficient route, even though you couldn't see it and you've never done it before. Your students rely on proprioception all day long. For example, to hug just the right amount, but not so hard to knock their friends over. Guide a pencil while looking up and down from the smart board with just the right amount of pressure. Cut smoothly with scissors, climb without looking their feet, and learn any new hand game, sport, or dance step in a timely fashion, and perform it in a coordinated manner. The other sense we didn't learn about in kindergarten is the vestibular sense. The receptors for the vestibular system are located in the inner ear, and detect movement and gravity. They enable us to balance, coordinate our eyes, head, and body to isolate the eyes from the head to read, and coordinate the eyes, hands, and legs to kick or catch a ball. Most critical in the classroom, the vestibular system enables us to sense and resist the pull of gravity, allowing students to sit upright with a straight back and stay seated in order to focus their attention on what's going on in class and isolate their hands from manipulative tests. Children who are hyporesponsive to vestibular input succumb to the pull of gravity by slouching and compensate, and I'm sure you can picture this, by supporting their heads with their hands or flopping over the table, which in turn detracts from attention and neat, efficient coloring and handwriting. Some children need a lot more movement than others and will seek it out unconsciously by getting up and down, fidgeting, shaking their legs, constantly changing their sitting position, or tipping their chair backwards so you think they're going to fall, but somehow they never do. If you demand that these students sit still, chances are they will slouch out of the chair and often shock themselves by landing on the floor. Children who are overwhelmed by vestibular input are earthbound and are afraid of heights, climbing, swinging, slides, and most playground equipment. The bottom line is, and this is a really important point, failure to sit may be equally likely a result of weak vestibular processing as a primary attentional deficit. Identifying the cause of the excess movement is critical in deciding how you're going to deal with it. Together, the tactile, vestibular, and proprioceptive systems provide our students with body awareness, which enables them to figure out above, below, under, over, and is the basis for directionality. It also enables them to sense where their bodies are in space in relationship to other children and objects so they can navigate through physical space. For example, body awareness enables them to sense and respect personal space and comfortably navigate a straight path from their desk to the cubbies without tripping, falling, and crashing. When children's tactile, vestibular, and proprioceptive senses are not fine-tuned, they may feel like they are lost in space and wearing moon shoes. The number one question that parents and teachers ask me about a particular child is, and in air quotes, is it sensory or behavior? Which I take to mean, is a child's behavior driven by sensory processing challenges, or does it have another origin? Why is it important to distinguish? As we said before, if a child has a sensory problem and you try to sticker chart it out of existence, it won't be effective. A sensory problem mandates a sensory strategy, and a problem that is behavioral in origin warrants a behavioral strategy. So let's go back to our original three students and see what you think now. You ready? Raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon if you think Chani's hands over her ears during davening, walking away from close contact with peers, lashing out when they come close, and refusing to touch art materials reflects poor manners and defiance. Click on the hand icon if you think Noam slouches and rests his body on the table because he's bored and has difficulty learning motor skills because he's not paying attention. And finally, click on the hand icon if you think Leora's constant movement, tripping, and falling is definitely due to ADHD. I actually see no hands up, which I'm pleased about, so let's posit an alternate theory. Sensory processing disorder is a disruption in the way we take in, process, and act on information from our bodies and our surroundings. If children get too much or too little stimulation or interpret it the wrong way, their behavior will be altered, as we said previously. When sensory signals are overpowering or not registered, children may feel threatened, lost in space, and disorganized. Several important points. Sensory processing challenges are not a cognitive disorder, and many students with sensory processing disorder are very bright. Sensory processing disorder can occur in isolation or comorbidly with autism, ADHD, learning disabilities, and many other conditions. What sets kids with sensory processing challenges apart from other children is that they feel uncomfortable in their own skin and are absolutely consumed by the need to make themselves feel okay. And until they do, they will be unavailable for learning. And that's why it's this important, and that is why this is important for teachers to know about. So kudos to you for tuning into this webinar. Let me try to give you a sense of how that feels, okay? Put on your imagination caps. Pretend there's a fly buzzing around your head. I offer you $1,000 if you can keep from swatting it. Your whole mind and body get into the act. Your arms and legs stiffen. Your arms are tight to your torso. You stare straight ahead and close your eyes, and you shudder every time the buzzing gets closer. Now, I up the ante and offer you another $1,000 if you can say the alphabet backwards. Despite your motivation, how available will you be for that cognitive task? That's how our kids feel. So let's see if we can reinterpret our three students' behaviors through the lens of sensory integration. Chani is sensory hypersensitive, also known as sensory over-responsive, or SOR. She perceives everything too much, is usually in fight or flight mode, and has hair trigger responses, shutting down, escaping, lashing out, or attempting to control everything around her, and these kids can be control freaks. The world is a dangerous place. To protect herself, Chani works very, very hard at keeping things the same so that nothing unexpected happens. Routine and predictability are essential. In contrast to Chani, Noam is a sensory underresponder, or SUR. He has a high threshold for sensation, so he feels too little, or it takes him a long time to sense what other students perceive and react to instantaneously. Leora is a sensory seeker. Like Noam, she has a high threshold for sensory input. It takes a lot for her to feel anything, but her response is completely different. Instead of succumbing to reduced sensory input and reacting slowly, Leora is driven to constantly seek sensory input to feed her nervous system, and she's a whirling dervish. There are students with similar sensory profiles and challenges whose response patterns in school, however, are completely different. Raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon if you've had parents complain, for example, that Sarah does not want to come to school in the morning and falls apart every day after school, and you reply, "I wish I had a classroom full of Sarahs." So let me explain or propose a hypothesis. Instead of doubting the mom, consider the following. Some very socially savvy children will bottle up all of the sensory-based anxiety they experience as their senses are assaulted all day long without overtly reacting, only to come home to a safe environment and completely decompensate. So when parents want to know what's going on in school to cause such distress, consider sensory challenges a possible culprit. And I have found that they often are. there are two primary products of sensory processing that we've been alluding to without labeling. One is self-regulation, which I think is a very popular term now, and the other is the ever-mysterious motor planning. And I'm going to explain them because they require sensory strategies that we'll discuss later. So bear with me. Self-regulation is the ability to control one's arousal level, alertness, and emotional and physical responses to sensory input appropriately in any environment. Our brains are constantly bombarded by sensory input. To function optimally, the brain needs to filter out irrelevant sensations and attend and respond to only the most salient information to, let's say, make it in the classroom. You can't attend to everything. So, for example, tuning into all the wonderful sensory richness on a beautiful day like today and moving nonstop with abandon, shouting out loud, and stopping to smell the roses is perfectly appropriate at recess. But the math class that follows requires being quiet, sitting still, and filtering out all of the ambient noise, sights, smells, to focus and attend to the teacher and the smart board. The well-regulated student will take in just the right amount of sensory information to go through his day in what's called a calm, alert state, without being distracted and inattentive. He will follow directions in a timely fashion, go with the flow, transition easily, and is resilient enough to tolerate changes in schedules, routines, and expectations. The second product of solid sensory processing is motor planning. Motor planning is the ability to have an idea, plan, organize, and sequence the steps to accomplish it, and execute it in a coordinated fashion in response to any environmental demand. So motor planning, figuring out how to fit your body to the environment in time and space, is also essential to entering ongoing play, learning a sport, sequencing the steps to make an art project, and figuring out how to stand behind the line on the floor rather than in front of it. So picture this. When most kids go into a playground, even a new one, they dive right in and almost immediately figure out how to interact with all of the equipment in multiple ways. The student with poor motor planning will run into the playground all excited, stop short, stare, and remain on the outside looking in as he struggles to figure out exactly how to fit his body into all of those slides, monkey bars, and a pickup soccer game, despite intact gross motor skills. Strange. To compensate, he may either run around, repeat the one motor activity or play schema he's mastered over and over again, or choose a sedentary activity such as reading a book or playing cards. He may play alone because he does not feel competent, fears proximity to other children, or fails to understand how to insert himself into ongoing peer play. To the chagrin of his classmates, he may inadvertently wreck a structure or game that other kids are playing as he fails to sense where his body is in relation to their bodies. Ironically, students who need more proprioceptive tactile and movement stimulation than other kids will deny themselves the opportunity unless a teacher intervenes. Also, note, students with motor planning challenges need much more practice than typically developing children to perform any motor task. And for many, the labor-intensive nature of task performance, say handwriting, is frustrating and discouraging, and they may opt out of the task altogether, though they need to do it to survive in school. So now that we have an understanding of what sensory processing disorder or sensory challenges are, even without a diagnosis, how do we approach it? I've consistently found that a two-pronged team approach is the most highly effective, and I'm going to branch that into three separate prongs. The first prong is intense sensory integration treatment by an occupational therapist in a sensory gym to alter the way the brain processes sensory input. This is a process and not a quick fix. And while it is underway, children, parents, and teachers still need to survive every day at home and in school. So the second prong is a consistent home program and maybe a sensory diet to help the child, family, and teacher cope with everyday life. The reason I include teacher is because sensory preparation at home before the school day begins can greatly enhance the start of the day for students with sensory processing challenges. The third prong, and this is where you come in, is sensory strategies, accommodations, and adaptations in school to eliminate the sensory challenges and open up students for learning. Part of this, as we discussed, is viewing the behavior through the lens of sensory integration. And here are the rest of the steps. Become a sensory detective. Promote self-regulation and motor planning proactively rather than reactively. And be prepared for the most challenging times of the day. So here we go. Here's the how-to. Your first step is to become a sensory detective by systematically observing your students for clues about their sensory strengths and challenges. Number one, observe the content of off-kilter behavior, not just are they behaving or not behaving, to figure out what your student avoids, rejects, is drawn to, or distracted by in an effort to identify the sensory system that's the culprit. So for example, Ella struggles to complete independent work at her desk. If she's distracted by noise, which is auditory, that will demand a different strategy than if she fiddles with items on her desk, which is tactile, or struggles to sit upright, which is proprioceptive and vestibular. When several behaviors stack up in one sensory system, that may indicate that it was a problem, that there's a problem processing information in that particular sensory system. Your next job is to look for patterns of behavior. Note when the child is most focused and engaged, and use that information proactively to set him up for success. Also, know when he decompensates, opts out, or becomes disorganized. For example, does he always fall apart when there's a crowd, such as the carpool line or gym? Does he act like the class clown when you or the PE teacher introduce a new movement activity? Does he have trouble staying at his desk when he needs to sit? Number three, look for signs of over-arousal and under-arousal, and those can cross sensory systems. Clues for over-arousal might include a controlling personality and escape tactics, such as covering ears, averting gaze, self-isolation, lashing out, and rejecting anything messy. Alternatively, some children flap, spin, or rock rhythmically to soothe themselves. Clues for under-arousal include nonstop movement or paucity of movement, daredevil behavior, or an undue degree of caution, doing things slowly, and an inability to do anything slowly. And finally, step four, look for immediate antecedents to problematic behavior. Eliminating students' triggers will help you prevent a breakdown. Step two, armed with all of this information, your primary objective should be to achieve an optimal level of arousal for learning, or a calm alert state, as we mentioned before. And we want to do this proactively before, instead of waiting for your student's behavior to fall apart. So we're going to divide this into techniques for individual children and class-wide techniques, and we're going to go back and forth. Here's how to help individual students. Number one, acknowledge what bothers the child. Giving the child the words to express her most secret fears and letting her know she isn't alone are incredibly powerful gifts. For example, Ella, I see that it is hard for you to tune out all of the activity in the classroom to work. When I was your age, it was hard for me too. All of the noise drowned out my thoughts. Does noise bother you too? Next, anticipate when the student will have a problem and assure her that you will warn her when an off-putting situation is coming up. You must be consistent so she will trust you. And last, collaborate with the child to develop socially acceptable solutions. You are the teacher, so whatever you decide is socially acceptable will be the norm in your classroom. And it is up to you to differentiate your sensory supports for individual students and let your class know that each student gets what they need in your classroom. For example, during independent seat work, provide Ella with noise-canceling headphones, have Noam sit on a therapy ball, and give Leo a chewing gum. Whenever you introduce new tools, I would recommend giving all of the students an opportunity to try them to demystify them. And generally, only the students who are going to benefit from these items will actually want to use them. Another point is modify your expectations for these children. There is no reason children should be challenged every minute of every day. As we know, the best learning does not occur under chronic stress. So enable your child to benefit from our educational program by eliminating or lessening the sensory barriers. Work hand in hand with the child's OT to set up realistic expectations and develop sensory hacks. Note, in school you could manage sensory-based behavior. In the clinic, the OT will work on rewiring the brain to improve the child's sensory processing and hopefully eliminate the need for all of these adaptations. Your most powerful class-wide tool to promote optimal arousal, self-regulation, and motor planning is systematically dosing out intense 2 to 3 minute sensory breaks throughout the day that incorporate heavy work and movement. Plan them at regular intervals, 1 to 1.5 hours, at times that make sense in your schedule to target the most challenging times of the day for your individual class. The 2 to 3 minutes you will invest during these sensory breaks will pay off in increased alertness, attention, engagement, and postural control, not only for the identified student, but for your entire class. Proprioceptive input is the most regulating sensation. So when you suspect that your students are dysregulated, but you can't figure out what's pushing their sensory buttons, provide heavy, resisted activities and stretch them. For example, have them do wall push-ups or chair push-ups, march, jump, squeeze palms and fingers together to make spiders, invert their hands, stretch resistive putty, and wash the tables and blackboards with giant car sponges. Preschoolers, of course, have lots more options, including Play-Doh, obstacle courses, follow the leader, crawling backwards, and animal walks. Under the guidance of an occupational therapist, an individual student can use a weighted lap buddy, weighted vest, or compression garment to ground him, or you can load a student's backpack with books. Also, you can allow children access to sensory bins filled with rice, beans, sand, therapy, stress balls, oral motor tools, and fidget toys to decrease sensory defensiveness and regulate their arousal. One of the most effective ways for a teacher to provide heavy work for an individual child is to designate him a classroom helper. Have him do the heavy lifting, such as pushing or moving furniture, putting away the heaviest toys, delivering books to another classroom, be the laptop or technology helper, and hold open those heavy fireproof doors for the other children to pass through. You are only limited by your creativity. Movement is the second component of a sensory break. Slow, even, rhythmic, repetitive movement like rocking, jogging in place, jumping jacks on the trampoline are organizing for most students. In addition, research has demonstrated that yoga is highly effective at getting students and teachers into a calm, alert state, and many public schools begin their day with yoga. To upregulate or energize your students, provide rapid, intense, arrhythmic, unpredictable movements such as the hokey pokey, chicken dance, or break dancing, or project sensory breaks for preschoolers from GoNoodle.com on your smart board. David Slatke's Energizing Brain Breaks, and I put the email address above, are terrific brief movement activities that combine motor and cognitive challenges for older students. Check them out on YouTube. They are absolutely terrific. Inverting the head also facilitates arousal. Try bear walks, elephant walks, a forward roll, yoga poses like downward dog, and picking up a pencil that, air quotes, accidentally landed on the floor. There are five key sensory hacks to creating a sensory smart environment in your classroom: predictability, organization, limiting visual overload, controlling sound, and smart seating. Click on the check icon if it helps you to know the outline of this webinar and when it was going to be over before we started. Click on the check if you have ever experienced flipping through the sitter to figure out when shul will be over, even on Yom Kippur, when you know you're going to be in shul all day.
I'm embarrassed to check, Chaya.
But there were a few honest souls out there, but I bet most of you would do this every now and then. Okay, put your hands down and uncheck your checks. If you were a child who couldn't read a clock, this webinar would seem endless. Most young children have no sense of time, but they thrive on structure, routine, and predictability. Provide concrete cues so sensory challenged students can mentally prepare for whatever is coming up next and allay the low-level anxiety that often accompanies these kids all day long. Tap into sight, sound, and movement to ease transitions throughout the day. Sound. Before starting a new activity, as simple as this seems, announce the activity that will follow and remind your students frequently. Several minutes before a transition, give a concrete clue for when the activity will change, such as, after you color one more picture, so it's no surprise when it's over. Sight and movement. Always have a visual schedule posted with pictures or words that all students can easily view. Create individual Velcro schedules like the poorly photographed one, red one on your screen, with icons or words representing the sequence of the day on the left, and have your sensory-driven student move a completed item to the right so he can see and control what's happening next. If you anticipate a schedule change, have that student rearrange the icons, imparting a sorely needed sense of control. Create additional manipulatable, if that's a word, schedules for morning and end of the day routines if needed. Organization. Organization simplifies the sensory processing demands on children who are overwhelmed, disorganized, or have difficulty sequencing. Label bins with pictures or words to clearly indicate where things go. Remove clutter, and I've never seen a classroom that was uncluttered and clean-looking enough. Teach organizational skills explicitly. Students with sensory processing challenges do not pick up on these skills organically. Your investment early in the year will pay substantial dividends in the long run. For example, teach children how to slide papers in a folder. Empty the folders with them regularly. Check for sharpened pencils and organized supply bins along with them, and teach them to color code by subject. For students who have difficulty learning the routines verbally, tap into vision and movement with Velcro lists as above. But for older students, you can try a 4x6 whiteboard. List the items in the sequence with a permanent marker and have the student check off each item with a dry erase marker as they complete it. Next idea, create visual calm. Try the following experiment in your classroom. Sit on the floor and see if your eyes find a place to rest. If you experience visual overload, it's time to simplify. I have two recommendations. One, regularly remove items from eye level that are no longer necessary. Two, cover items irrelevant to the current session by tacking roll-up Velcro shades to the wall and covering up, say, math principles during language arts, or cover up the calendar and weather when reading a story. Now it's time to reduce the ambient noise in your classroom. Place tennis balls on the chair legs. To indicate that they are paying attention, have students do a gesture like waving their hand instead of clapping. To limit shouting out, have kids do a thumbs up when they agree with the speaker instead of shouting out. Music can also be used judiciously to energize or impart calm in your classroom. Even tempo, slower, rhythmic music, such as classical music or nature sounds, are calming. Louder music with a strong beat, such as rap, and a range of volume can be very alerting, so don't use it at rest time. And strange as it may seem, female vocalists tend to be very alerting and are almost never calming. Or for noise-canceling, headphones or earbuds to students who are startled or distracted by sound. And have earmuffs available in the dress-up corner for children who may want to use them. For preschoolers, create a safe space in your classroom where they can go to collect themselves when you or they sense that they're becoming overwhelmed. Buy a burrow, like the little girl sitting above, or a pop-up tent, or designate a hideaway under a loft or behind some furniture. Fill it with calming, regulating items such as soft pillows, books, stuffed animals, a weighted lap buddy, soft heavy blankets and mouth tools, or whatever is regulating for the particular students you are targeting. Guide them when you sense that they are becoming overwhelmed and need to shut out sights and sounds. Through this process, students will learn to tune into their own sensory signals and be empowered to control their environments. For kids who are 7 years old and older, the ALERT program is an excellent way to teach children to tune into their body's signals. Partner with your older over-responsive students to find a safe space they can retreat to with impunity to head off sensory overload. Many students with sensory processing challenges have difficulty maintaining an upright posture and melt into other children, the wall or the floor. Some children cannot stay seated and keep changing their position. Note the following, because this is really important. Because of the way we are wired, low muscle tone and a weak core are often part and parcel of sensory challenges. Here's what you can do. To strengthen posture and alertness, do sensory break activities immediately before sit-down time. So now we're going to talk about sitting on the floor and sitting at the table.
Chaya, you know what? I just want to do a little just time check. Can we aim for about 2 minutes a slide? Does that work?
Yeah, you just tell me when they're up. Okay.
No, I don't want to do that.
Okay,
it just means
we're good.
We run a little fast. Yeah, okay. All right, thanks.
You want me to? Okay, sure. Okay. Carpet time. Some children cannot sit crisscross applesauce because they have a weak core or tight hamstrings. Instead, they end up lying on the floor, W-sitting, or constantly changing position in an effort to fight gravity. Try the following. A sit-move cushion on the floor. Let them lean against a wall or a bookcase. Put a standing chair on the floor or show them how to straddle a chair for stability. If their posture collapses, switch their sitting position frequently. For students who get too close to their friends on the carpet, provide clear, unambiguous boundaries, such as a carpet square whose edges they can actually see since their sense of feeling is underdeveloped, or use an inflated disc or wedge to provide subtle movement, or a chair to sit on the usual way, or the backwards way. Sitting at a table has numerous interesting options to facilitate sitting, and the best sitting arrangement is the one that works for your individual student. Important to note, children must have hips, knees, and ankles at 90-degree angles and their feet flat on the floor to support their backs and give them the clue for upright. Students who compensate by dangling their feet will slouch and need to constantly change position and get up and down, and their fine motor work will suffer. There's numerous kinds of chairs to provide in-seat movement, including the ones we mentioned before, and I want to note that ergo accordion chair that the kid is sitting on in the slide is my latest favorite, but yoga ball chairs, the core disc, all have a place. Pedal chairs and standing tables provide maximum movement without the need to get out of one seat. Here are several educational strategies to use throughout the day, and I think if you're on this webinar, I'm preaching to the converted, so I'll just mention some of them. A multisensory approach will captivate those students who don't process sensation the way other kids do, so use multisensory materials. For students with motor planning challenges, particularly, provide a model of the end product before they start. Break tasks into component parts and provide the materials and instructions for one step only. Provide repetition and practice to teach and refine any motor skills, because that's what motor planning sufferers require. Never ask a student with a motor planning or sequencing challenge to go first. They will benefit from watching many students go before them. For students with auditory challenges, use simple language and have the student repeat the instructions back to you. If they can't follow your verbal instructions, add visual input by demonstrating. If that's not enough information, provide hand-over-hand guidance, but always ask permission before you touch a child with tactile defensiveness, and when you do, use firm pressure only. For students who have low arousal, warn them before you're going to call on them, and then allow them time for a verbal or motor response. Now let's break the school day down into challenging times of the day, and we'll discuss as many as time permits. So, Sarah, just give me a five-minute warning when my time is up, okay?
Okay.
All right, starting the day. As soon as children enter the building, our priority should be to get them well-regulated to set up for success. Don't wait for preschoolers who have difficulty initiating play to flounder. As soon as they walk in the door, coach them through the beginning of the day routine, which might require a visual organizer, and direct them to a specific activity. Provide a power pack, such as a heavy backpack, for children who need grounding until they settle down. Creating a social story about school and reading it at home will allow a student to practice the transition in a safe environment and gain control. For older children, the multisensory overload from the bus, a large, noisy, disorganized gym with kids running all around can push all of their sensory buttons and lead to difficulty with separation, school refusal, and even shutdown. If possible, ask the parent to bring the child right before class. If that's not possible, allow the child to go directly to the classroom or a smaller, quieter space. And as soon as they walk in, give them a specific job incorporating heavy work to ground and organize them. Chewing gum, which is heavy rhythmic work for the mouth, is a great grounding strategy. Sports top bottles are also effective, but not nearly as much. Hands down, circle and carpet time recited is one of the most challenging times of the day for students with any vulnerabilities whatsoever. So, quickly, click on the check mark if you hear a challenge that you have observed. Ready? Go. Sitting on or too close to other students. Lying down on the floor instead of sitting. Ending up in the middle or way outside of the circle. Constantly changing position. Touching classmates. Fiddling with anything on the floor. Difficulty focusing. Hands over eyes. Averting the eyes. Spacing out. Calling out. Difficulty imitating. Why is it so challenging? Because we are asking our students to control their bodies and space without postural support in relationship to other little bodies that are moving in space when confronted with intense visual and auditory overload, and yet they must focus on the lesson. The teacher is usually sitting on a chair. My number one suggestion is keep it short. When children are fidgeting, it is time to stop. Gauge whether your class needs alerting or calming and get the whole class in sync with a sensory break movement activity before they sit down. Assign seating to students who cannot make wise choices. For students who are tactile seekers, provide fidget toys attached to their waistband with a carabiner so they don't become projectiles. For students with poor motor planning and sequencing, who are always a few steps behind, send home a video of the routine to practice with parents at home so that they get all of that extra practice they need. For students overwhelmed by visual stimuli and avert their gaze, don't demand eye contact. In a simpler environment with fewer fluorescents, eye contact will emerge with comfort level. Gaze aversion is not the same as inattention. For students who are overwhelmed by noise, as we said before, try earbuds, noise-canceling headphones, and encourage them to sing or clap the loudest. For older students, modify the environment to maximize their ability to work independently. But you need to get buy-in. I find it best to strategize together with students. When they are concerned about looking different, I try to respect that and figure out a workaround to get them what they need without making them feel different. And I'll highlight just a few more strategies that we haven't mentioned yet. For tactile seekers, place a strip of Velcro under the desk for them to scratch. For movement seekers, make sure their seating is perfectly well adjusted to provide movement and support, and place a loop of stretchy band around the legs of the chair, like TheraBand, so that they can kick for proprioceptive input. To help with time management, which is a frequent problem these kids have, provide visual and auditory cues with timers, and you can experiment to see what works best. Kitchen timers, an hourglass app, and the clock app. Centers and free play, which I think is an important one, even if I don't get to any others. Provide a rich variety of ever-changing materials that can be touched, smelled, listened to, observed, and tasted to build your students' sensory motor skills. But while free play implies free choice, it behooves teachers to note, especially preschool teachers, if there are centers, activities, and social opportunities that a child consistently avoids and evaluate whether it's a preference or a weakness. For children who are aversive to touch, remove the pressure of physically interacting with icky substances, let's say sand, and find ways for them to join their classmates at the sand table, and not miss out socially. So for example, have them hand out the shovels and act as the project manager. Give them a pair of disposable gloves so they can experiment with the sand through a barrier and learn its properties. And over time, you can entice them to actually touch the sand by cutting off the fingers of the gloves by themselves one at a time when they're ready. To build up interactive play, give half the materials for a game or building structure to each child in a diet that you've constructed. Enforce rules during center time to ensure that children experience several centers every day, because kids with SPT, many kids do not like variety, and label each center with a minimum or maximum number of children to make sure children are not either isolated or overwhelmed. Most children with sensory processing issues are loath to transition even to their favorite activities. So many of these recommendations appeared earlier, but just to add one, don't give students generalized directions. If you want them to clean up, tell them specifically what to do. Operationalize it, not clean up or clean up the last toy you played with, but pick up the red blocks and put them on the blue shelf. Standing in line and walking through the hallways is a daily challenge for children who crash into other children, can't help touching their neighbors, and are generally lost in space. Make footprints in front of the preschool classroom door so students know exactly where to stand. Give their those feet a destination. If your class needs organizing input, have them march, jump, or hop through the hallways. Allow a preschooler who is not aware of his body position in space to hold the teacher's hand or be the line leader, and allow him to anchor himself to the wall by trailing his hand if there's no artwork in the way and he needs that tactile cue. Ask a child who needs grounding to be the door holder. Provide fidget toys for tactile seekers who can't keep their hands off the wall but don't need to be touching the wall. One quick word about specials. For hypersensitive kids who thrive on sameness and routine, an unfamiliar teacher, a new cavernous music room or gym with distressing echoes, new routines, unclear expectations, and grouping with students from other classes is absolutely overwhelming and they may absolutely refuse to go. So here are some strategies. Buddy up your student with a kind student who's comfortable in the special. For PE, buddy him up with a strong motor planner who's patient and kind. Modify the special teacher's expectations. For example, first accept sitting in the room as participation, then sitting amongst the other students as participation, and slowly joining in when the student is acclimated. Keep it short. A successful 10 minutes is more productive than 30 minutes in orange. Prepare the child by getting a clear sense of what will happen during that session. Should I continue?
Yeah, keep going.
Recess can make it or break it socially, but recess is a skill that some children need to learn. It's always sad to see a child who's on the outside looking in. So for children with poor motor planning, here are several options. Sometimes pair that child with a good motor planner who's inclusive. To prevent every recess from being a challenge, at other times find an activity at that child's comfort level and entice other students to join in. Subtly coach the child, your targeted child, to enter ongoing play by slowing down the play, deviously asking questions of the playmates, and repeating back the answers to provide clear clues for the child who is on the outside looking in so that they know what to do. Let parents know which games are being played at recess and recommend that they practice them at home, breaking the activity into its component parts and practicing them. Sensory seekers, the little scary ones in the playground, may crave the high of being at the edge of danger. As high as they can go, teetering on the edge of anything and upside down. You're sure they're going to land in the hospital, but they rarely do. Give them strict limits for risky activities to get the stimulation they crave and then have them move on to something else. The lunchroom is another key opportunity for socialization that's so off-putting to so many of our kids. Students who suffer from multisensory overload either suffer through lunch or isolate themselves. If the student has a one-on-one aide, and we didn't talk about aides too much, they should be on the job, pairing them up with another student and taking them to a quieter table. If the lunchroom is too anxiety-provoking, guide a small group of students to a smaller room, a different group of them every day, and give it a catchy name and make it a privilege to be invited.